Our first speaker is Dr. Rajiv Agarwal. Dr. Agarwal is an associate professor of medicine at Indiana University School of Medicine. He works predominantly at the Veterans Administration Hospital there and is an expert in hypertension, anemia, and in particular, iron utilization and administration in CKD and ESRD patients. And he will be talking on the independent benefits of IV iron beyond raising hemoglobin levels. Rajiv?
Thanks, Dan. I'm going to talk to you about the issue of the independent benefits of IV iron. We usually think about iron in as a helper in raising hemoglobin when we are giving erythropoietin. And hopefully at the end of the talk you would be convinced that we are using iron not simply to raise hemoglobin but also repleting an important element which is important for a lot of biological functions in the body. And something that piqued my interest was this lady I took care of, I still take care of, she's on dialysis. She is several years older now, but at that time she was 41-year-old black lady. She's got hypertension and glomerulonephritis causing her kidney disease, and she's been on dialysis since a very young age. About 15 years of age, she got on dialysis. And she had failed two previous transplants. Her hemoglobin has been pretty stable, 15.4 for the last 2 years. And whenever you see this erythrocytosis, you wonder, does she have a tumor causing EPO production? But she denied any fever, weight loss, or hematuria, and she has been pretty stable for many years. She takes oral iron, 200 milligrams per day, but she's not an EPO. She's obviously doesn't need any EPO. And she complained of being sleepy and tired all the time, and she actually told me that she needs her iron. And I looked at her monthly labs and she had a transferrin saturation of 5% and a serum ferritin of 30. And then I had a question in my mind. Her hemoglobin is 15.4, but her labs look iron deficient. What should I do? What would you do in this patient? She has a normal hemoglobin and iron deficiency is not a cause of her symptoms. How many people would think that? I mean, I was one who was thinking that. I mean, I'll be honest. Patient is not an EPO, iron stores iron material. Well, in part that's true because if you look at the package insert for any of the intravenous iron products, they say the patient has to be on EPO to qualify for this therapy, at least in dialysis patients. Or although there's no anemia, iron deficiency can cause symptoms, I would use IV iron. Hopefully you'll say yes at the end of the talk, but I was thinking more like, one, hemoglobin is normal, iron doesn't matter enough. Well, I went back to the literature and I found this study and I'm going to share it with you. It's a very old study, it's more than 30 years old. It was done in Seattle by Dr. Finch, and Dr. Finch was an expert on anemia and he did some wonderful studies where he took animals and he made them iron deficient by simply giving them an iron deficient chow. So the rats' diet contains iron. And they were being now given a diet which didn't have any iron. So if you give no iron to this animal, then they get iron deficient and they get anemic and you can see a hemoglobin of 6.4. And then you can take this animal and you can either choose to treat it or leave it untreated. And as controls, you can give it iron deficient diet but inject it with iron, or you can give it normal diet and continue to follow the patient. In this case, these are rat doctors, so the patients are the rats. And at the end of a month, what he did was he performed an exchange transfusion. He got the hemoglobin level to 6.4 in all the animals. what he is studying is iron deficiency with anemia then, okay? And every day, a technician came in and transfused the animal to raise the hemoglobin somewhat. On day one, the hemoglobin was increased by 1. On day 2, by 2, 3, 4, 7, 9. Well, there's a Saturday and Sunday, so you don't see 2 days there. That's the technicians refused to do it every day. They wanted the weekend. And what he did was he simply put them on a treadmill. So this is an NIH-funded study. This is 30 years ago. And he puts them on a treadmill and sees how far can they run before they fall off the treadmill. And he just takes a stopwatch, and the technician has a stopwatch and just counting the number of minutes that rat runs before he falls off the treadmill. So here's the graph. And on the x-axis, you have the number of days. It's not the days that the rat is running, but it's the days that the experiment was performed. And on the y-axis, the running time in minutes. And you can see clearly that this graph, this curve, is different from these curves, okay? These curves are clearly different. These three curves look very similar, and this curve looks very different. So who are these animals who are falling off very early? These are the iron-deficient, untreated animals. Look at this. At day 10, the hemoglobin is normal. The hemoglobin is 12. They are non-anemic, but still iron deficient, but they can't run. And if you treat this animal, they can run pretty well. They can run as much as a normal control rat. Remember, what you're seeing is the effect of anemia. If you're anemic, the rat can't run. If you're less anemic, at a hemoglobin of 12, the rat can run pretty well. But a hemoglobin of 12 with iron deficiency impairs the ability to perform physical activity here in the animal. Well, he wasn't satisfied. He said, well, we'll now do an experiment where we get the hemoglobin to 12 in all the animals. So first he does the experiment where he's producing iron deficiency, but he now maintains a hemoglobin of 12 in all the animals. So now the only factor that you're testing is iron deficiency. So you have iron deficiency either for 3 weeks or 4 weeks, and you have animals which are either treated or untreated. At 4 weeks, you have a treated iron deficiency or untreated iron deficiency. So if iron deficiency was the problem at 3 weeks and 4 weeks, you would expect that the rats would fall off the treadmill pretty soon. Let's see if that happens. And you can see this curve right at the bottom. That's untreated iron deficiency for 4 weeks. The rats can't run. They fall off the treadmill within 3 minutes, whereas a normal rat can run nearly 20 minutes, more than some people in the room can run. He is doing pretty good. Whereas the untreated iron deficiency is not doing too good. But you treat the iron deficiency and you maintain the hemoglobin, they can do pretty well. Well, the conventional wisdom is that, oh, there's hemoglobin, there's myoglobin, there's cytochrome C, they must be playing a role. So that was the next step. Dr. Finch said, well, you know, let's figure out what's causing the problem. It may be the myoglobin. And he did that. And what you see is, here's the myoglobin, muscle myoglobin. This is the control animal. Iron deficient or iron treated doesn't make a difference. The animals who are iron treated can run pretty well, but their myoglobin levels remain low. So myoglobin levels are not the cause of them not being able to run. And here you see these three graphs look pretty same, and this looks very different. And what this is cytochrome A, B, and C. And this is iron deficient and iron treated. And iron treated looks very similar to iron deficient. So this mustn't be the cause. It's not cytochromes, it's not myoglobin, which is causing the inability to run. What they figured out is there's an enzyme in the mitochondria, which is a complicated name, alpha-glycerophosphate, in the skeletal muscle. It's a mitochondrial enzyme, which is important for the performance of oxidative phosphorylation. And in the iron deficient animals, it falls, and in the iron treated animals, it rises. So iron is actually impacting mitochondrial function, which is then in turn impairing our physical performance. I haven't found this kind of a study in a human being, otherwise I would have shown it to you. I actually am not a rat doctor, I'm a human doctor. But, you know, there isn't any such study in humans. But I think there's a very compelling evidence that iron deficiency itself can impair physical activity. In fact, there was an old paper in Scientific American. I read it about 20 years ago. And they looked at workers in Indonesia, and they supplemented them with oral iron. And their performance improved. When they have iron deficiency, they could. They had less time off work. They could perform more work in the factory, and it improved their performance. It was like an anecdote that was published in Scientific American by this famous person who was an expert in iron metabolism. But they're anecdotes. But I think there's probably some truth behind it. What we did in our patient was. Treated the patient with IV iron. Those days we had iron dextran, and I gave her a gram of iron dextran over $10 treatments. And within a week she was feeling great. And iron deficiency without anemia could have caused the patient's symptoms. You might say that it was a placebo effect, but even if it was a placebo, it worked for the patient. Well, I'm going to walk you through another scenario. We have heard about when we give intravenous iron that it can cause infections, and there's this great controversy between iron causing infections. In fact, what I'm going to show you is quite the opposite. Here's a study which can be performed in iron deficient children. These are children with iron deficiency anemia, and they have a hemoglobin less than 10, and they have a bone marrow iron performed, and in all of these children, there's hypochromic microcytic anemia, and these are all between 1 and 8 years of age. So the investigators divided these children into moderate iron deficiency and severe iron deficiency, and they have a matched group of normal controls with no anemia or iron deficiency. And what they did was they measured neutrophil function, and you can measure it by looking at the ability of the neutrophil to kill bacteria. So you expose the neutrophil to Staph aureus and look at how many Staph aureus are remaining at 20 minutes compared to at baseline. So that's a called an intracellular bacterial killing. They also look at the oxidative burst by looking at something called nitroblue tetrazoleum test. You know, the way the neutrophils attack the bacteria is by mounting an oxidative response. And by doing that, you can look at not just the bacterial killing, but also the neutrophil function. And they did it at baseline, and then after giving them iron for about 4 to 7 days, and they treated them all with IV iron or parenteral iron. So you can see that these two, the bacterial killing is pretty impaired in children with moderate iron deficiency or severe iron deficiency. They have a lot of bacteria remaining at 20 minutes compared to this control group of children. And when you treat them with IV iron, they have very few bacteria after a week of giving IV iron. The oxidative burst, which is a test of neutrophil function, is quite impaired at baseline, very low compared to the healthy controls. But after you give them IV iron, it comes to control levels. In other words, you need iron to have the adequate performance of neutrophil function. You have to mount a response to kill the bacteria, and also the oxidative machinery to do that. And here's a benefit of giving intravenous iron. Well, iron also is very important for brain function, and there's a very rich literature out there which suggests that it's important for neurotransmitter synthesis uptake and degradation. It's important for mitochondrial function that I already told you about in skeletal muscle, and the same mitochondria also exist in the brain, which is metabolically most active in at least some of us, maybe not after a few glasses of wine, but and there's issues with protein synthesis and brain iron deposition. If you talk to oncologists, they'll tell you the best. You know, this concept of pica. They'll tell you that this patient has pica. They came to my office. They were having ice chips, and we gave them intravenous iron, and they threw the ice away, and it all disappeared even before the anemia got corrected. You won't find published reports, but anybody who has treated these people with severe iron deficiency knows that this exists. We'll talk a little bit about the restless leg syndrome, the cognitive function, and thermoregulation. So first we'll talk about the cognitive function. And here's a study which was done in Baltimore. Adolescent girls in four Baltimore high schools. The investigators went around and looked for iron deficiency with anemia. The serum ferritin was less than 12. The hemoglobin was more than 11.5 for blacks, 11 more than 12 for whites. Actually, there should be iron deficiency without anemia because the hemoglobin is in the normal range. But they're iron deficient. And 98 girls had non-anemic iron deficiency. About 15%. In other words, the hemoglobin was normal, but the iron was low. And then they randomly assigned these 98 girls to either ferrosulfate by mouth or placebo, and they measured cognitive function by standard questionnaires at baseline and at 8 weeks. So here are 98 girls that I identified, 17 refused participation, 81 are enrolled, and 40 are randomized to iron, 41 to placebo. And a fair number of them, 90%+ complete the trial. They are teenage girls, 16 years, 50% are whites, and hemoglobin average is 13, and a ferritin of 9, maximum is 9.1. By anybody's definition, they're quite iron deficient, but they have a normal hemoglobin. What they do then is look at recall of words. First of all, they look at the hemoglobin performance. In the iron-treated girls, the hemoglobin rises somewhat, 0.4, and in the control girls, it falls somewhat. Perhaps they were bleeding these girls to get the assays done for iron and hemoglobin and all that. And the ferritin goes up in the iron-treated girls and doesn't change much in control. But here's the actual meat, and you can see that these are all graphs which the lines are pointing up, but this red line is different from the other three. Now, what does this mean? Well, they're looking at simply how many words you recall at the first try, at the second try, and the third try. So if I give you the same test three times, you're going to improve, right? And that's what it shows. The first try, you don't do too well. The second try, you can recall more words. And the third try, you recall even more. But if you're treated with iron, you recall more words at baseline, at the second trial, and the third trial, and that's statistically significant from if you got no iron at all. And so this is the baseline iron group in the yellow, and the red one is after they have been treated with iron. And you can see there's a significant improvement at each of the three recalls. If you get placebo, you don't improve. So your ability to recall, which is a test of cognitive function, improves when you have had very little change in hemoglobin, but simply repletion of iron in your brain. And perhaps this reflects mitochondrial function, neurotransmitter function. Recall is a tough thing to define. But here's a statistically significant improvement in recall performance. what about restless leg syndrome? And here I show you data in normal people, normal controls, and patients with restless leg syndrome. And you might say, gee, have you labeled it wrong? Iron, serum iron is higher, ferritin is higher. It should be the other way around. The answer is no, I haven't labeled it wrong. It just it turns out that there's no statistical significance between these differences in the means. In other words, if you look at the serum parameters of iron, of ferritin and transferrin saturation, there are no differences between people who have restless leg syndrome versus who don't have restless leg syndrome. But if you sample their cerebrospinal fluid and you do the same parameters, you find that iron in the restless leg syndrome is actually higher, the ferritin is markedly lower, and the transferrin saturation is also higher. So the saturation that is actually, if you do the ratio, it actually comes out low, and the ferritin is definitely low in the CSF of the patients with restless leg syndrome. If you do even more sophisticated imaging studies in which you actually look at iron concentration in the substantia nigra, which is supposed to be the culprit and it's supposed to be mediating movement disorders, you can see that there's a lot of white in the control, which tells you that there's a fair amount of iron. This is a specific test for iron imaging in the brain, which lately has gotten a lot of interest in neurology. And you can see there's a lot of white out here in the control people, and in the patients with restless leg syndrome, there's actually reduced iron, which suggests that it's really a state of regional iron deficiency. The fact that they don't have enough iron in the substantia nigra is the reason why they have restless leg syndrome. If you look at the actual numbers in these patients, you can see that the brain iron concentrations are much lower compared to the normal subjects. Even though they're only 5 and 5, it seems like it's working out at least for these investigators. So more recently, there was a trial done with IV iron in people with restless leg syndrome on hemodialysis. These are 14 people who get placebo, and they're looking at restless leg score at 0 week, at 1 week, 2 week, and 4 weeks. And you can see that restless legs continues pretty much the same throughout the 4 weeks of the trial when they're getting placebo. When they're getting IV iron, the restless leg score actually improves and stays improved, at least for the 2 weeks. It's kind of a proof of concept. There are not great numbers here. There are 14 patients here, 11 patients here. Despite that, there's some improvement in the restless leg syndrome, suggesting that iron may actually be mediating some of the movement disorders that we see in our patients on hemodialysis. Lastly, we're going to talk about thermoregulation. So oftentimes you'll hear your patient say, "Doc, I feel very cold." And you look at the hemoglobin and it may be normal. And I say, "No, no, you're not anemic, you're fine." But I would like to tell you that maybe they're iron deficient, and that's why they are having an impaired ability to thermoregulate. And this is an experiment done in humans. It was done by Dr. Finch's group, the same person who did the rat study. He went to South America, and he took farmers, and he found farmers who were willing to volunteer to be submersed in a cold water bath and be studied for several hours there. He found normal people, and he found people who had iron deficient, non-anemic state. So they had a hemoglobin, which was pretty normal, and but they were iron deficient, or they had iron deficiency anemia, and he simply measured oral temperature, norepinephrine, and oxygen consumption in these farmers. Now you can see here that the normal individuals and the iron deficient, non-anemic individuals and anemic individuals, they're about the same age, young people, probably got paid a little bit to do the study. Hemoglobin is pretty low here, and these are clearly iron deficient. Here the numbers look quite similar. If you look at the oral temperature, the temperature drops even in people who have normal hemoglobin. Drops a little bit. But if you are non-anemic iron deficient, your normal hemoglobin but you're iron deficient, or you're anemic and iron deficient, it doesn't matter, your temperature drops much more than the control situation. And you kind of look at these two graphs, that these two look very similar and this looks different, and that's the plasma norepinephrine. The epinephrine response is much more robust in iron deficient non-anemic and iron deficient anemic individuals compared to normal. And you can see this response and this response is no different, but this looks different. So they are having a much more of a catecholamine response. And on this side, I've just shown you the time course at 15 minutes, 30 minutes, 45 minutes, 1 hour. That's when they are taken off this cold water bath. And they have quite a stimulated catecholamine release. In fact, it doesn't matter whether they are anemic or not anemic. If they are iron deficient, they have the same kind of a increased surge in catecholamines at 1 hour after cold exposure. Same thing with oxygen consumption. It doesn't matter if you have anemia or no anemia. You have very little change in oxygen consumption, but you increase your oxygen consumption quite a bit if you have iron deficiency with or without anemia. And you can see it's much more in the iron deficient anemic individuals, but the iron deficient non-anemic individuals also have quite an increase in oxygen consumption. What this means is that if you have a fall in body temperature and you have an increase in metabolic activity, which means that you have an increase in oxygen consumption, it suggests there's heat loss with iron deficiency. Okay, so your temperature dropped despite an increase in metabolic activity, your oxygen consumption had increased. That means you're losing heat. And you're not losing heat for any other reason. Probably it suggests that there's some defect in the mitochondria of these individuals by which there's uncoupling of oxidative phosphorylation. There's an increase in catecholamines and oxygen consumption, which is similar in anemic or non-anemic individuals who have tissue iron deficiency, not just anemia. So you might say, okay, if you have an anemic, you're vasodilated, you'll dissipate heat, but that's not true. The non-anemic individuals are doing it as much. It seems like it might be a utilization of energy which might be at fault rather than anemia as such. So to conclude, iron is important for continued RBC production in patients treated with EPO. We know that quite well, everybody in this room does. Dietary iron or oral iron is not enough to keep up with the ongoing iron losses, especially when you're treated with EPO, and we need maintenance IV iron therapy to maintain RBC production. It's important for neutrophil and skeletal muscle function, and iron deficiency, even without anemia, may have clinically significant effects. I agree that the literature on this is not very intense. We don't have 100 studies like an ACE inhibitor or blood pressure reduction or proteinuria, but I think that it's intriguing to understand that iron may have independent effects aside from hemoglobin. An iron deficiency rather than low hemoglobin may contribute to clinical symptomatology that we have traditionally attributed to anemia. For example, feeling cold or having impaired cognitive function or just forgetting things or not feeling right. It might be not anemia, but it might be iron deficiency which might be contributing. Thank you very much for your attention. I'd like to take a few questions.